like to introduce our next speaker, who's Professor John Dwyer, who was the founder of the Australian Healthcare Reform Alliance, and he's going to take us to what next.
Well, thank you, Jo. dear colleagues, as you can imagine, I think, if you think about it for a second, this has been quite an emotional couple of days for me. When you get to be 75, you naturally tend to look forward to this and that, but you tend to look backwards and see what you've done in your life that you might feel very comfortable about. And one of the things that I've done that I'm delighted to have been associated with was setting up this organisation. And I can't tell you how much I thank Tony and the team for carrying on and building the organisation and making what it is today a highly respected voice in terms of advocating healthcare, for better healthcare standards, for healthcare reform. And that gives me a great deal of satisfaction. I think I see ACRA as belonging to the intellectual left. The intellectual left is in dire straits in Australia, in my opinion. We're of the emotional left as well, because there's a passion about the individual organisations that contribute to ACRA that's great to see. And in these presentations, there's been a lot of passion. Some of that passion is frustration, but also determination. But it's no use being just of the emotional left. And ACRA we've got to be seen as advocating for something which we also can back up from an evidence-based approach to being logical and important, and that's, I think, a crucial issue for us as we go forward. I just want to run through a few slides I've got, which repeat information that you've already got. Some of them take a different slant on it, and I want to spend a few minutes talking about what we haven't talked much about, which is the implication in the current budget for hospital services, which make the priority of improving our primary care system ever more important. So I'll run through a few slides with you, and away we go. Now, the two things that I've heard, wonderful things in the last couple of days, but two things that have resonated with me is the advice we've had from a number of sectors, and it became self-evident, that there isn't a clear vision being presented for what sort of healthcare system Australia wants and needs and can afford. Now, there's gross confusion in Canberra about that, and not even much of an effort to articulate just what it is that contemporary Australia needs. It's pathetic to think that Australians have been asked, particularly poorer Australians, to pay more and more for the same old without there being any vision about structural reform that might improve things. And at the very first meeting of, just as soon after ACRA was born, we actually had a meeting, as some of you are at, with Tony Abbott. And we presented this to him as our goal, what we thought should be the descriptor of the Australian healthcare system, and this has been expanded upon on the website of ACRA in its principles. I've just condensed it here into a statement here. But the various elements of this, a system focused on the individual that emphasises prevention, is demonstrably equitable, sustainable, and provides evidence-based quality care in a timely manner, available on the basis of need, not personal financial well-being. And it was maybe a sign of what was to come that Tony Abbott actually laughed and said, "You are our dreamers. That's a utopian view of the world." That's what he said to us. We went on at that same meeting to argue with him that really you should ask Australians, have a conversation with Australians to see if they think that's utopian and ridiculous and the like. And I remember distinctly, it stuck in my mind because it seemed to be such a trite statement, but he said to us, I tried to have a conversation with Australian women about in vitro fertilisation, and it was hopeless, he said. And we all sort of thought, gee, this is... But this, I believe, does remain the goal, and it could be used as a barometer to see whether or not our health reforms we are advocating are coming around, because this is not a description of the current health system. But it is a description of something which I increasingly believe is not only achievable, but is desirable, more desirable than ever. And the evidence base for this and the evidence from other countries that are obviously pursuing similar goals leads us to think that this is definitely part of the intellectual left, not the emotional left. Now, we all know that this new government before elected promised no reduction in health expenditure. It would support the National Disability Insurance Scheme, be no cuts to education, no hint that university education would become more expensive. So, what did we reasonably expect? What would Australians expect from an intelligent, modern government looking at the priorities for health, for example? And the first one I've got here is the theme that Catherine King brought up as we started the conference, a clearly delineated vision for the health system contemporary Australia needs. And I do believe that that is one of the major focuses for ACRA now, is to put out an ever clearer, community-orientated description of just what it is that we want, and to continue and amplify the conversation with Australia to get that community support for it. What we had every right to expect were necessary changes to unshackle reform efforts. That is a commitment to a system reform, not just asking us to pay more for the same old, same old. And a renewed commitment to healthcare equity. What drives so many of us, from frontline people who see it in a day-to-day life to people whose organisations are surrounded by it, is the fact that Australia really is a polarised society, and increasingly so, with many people doing very nicely, thank you, enjoying the fruits of a very well-developed, rich country. But more and more, especially in the health area, we see gross inequity in the system, access to quality services becoming more and more difficult. And, of course, the current budget is only making that situation worse. So the request to the Abbott government, in all of the preamble are coming up, you look at the editorials that were written, some of them by yours truly, I think it's fair to say that almost all health reform experts said to the government pre-budget, GDP expenditure on health is only 9.1%. You've got no cause for panic. And your concern for the rising costs of Medicare, $19 billion a year, is misplaced when hospital expenditure exceeds $140 billion a year and is growing at a much faster rate than Medicare. In fact, as we heard this morning, Medicare expenditure is really only just marginally growing. And we could say, and we did say, to Peter Dutton, the minister, we know, Mr. Dutton, that you are focusing on Medicare expenditure because of the wretched jurisdictional divisions that uniquely plague Australia, Australian healthcare. But true leadership from your government would see more money spent on primary and community programs to save many more dollars from reduced hospital admissions. But in the system where federal politicians are looking at the federal contribution to health, which they're desperately anxious to reduce. And as I say, one of the big dangers is, I think, that this government would like to be out of the health business altogether, certainly to very much reduce its footprint. But the fact that all of that emphasis was on we can't sustain Medicare, rather than having a federal minister for health who could take a whole of system approach, is one of the real weaknesses that we've been plagued with for years and years. And back when ACRA was formed, we were saying, please, we have got to move to have one single funder for the health system and to get away from this cost shifting, this split responsibilities, which no other OECD country has to labour with. And I think that, again, it was fair to say to the government before the budget, not that they listened, But listen, you know, before you go asking Australians to pay more, if you won't change the system, but just imagine this. If you're asking us to pay more, surely as a government, you should look and see where there are major cost inefficiencies that could be tackled. And we could say to the government, and this is the reason I want to talk about hospitals, is we haven't emphasised this enough in the last couple of days. We have a major problem because we are not reducing the number of avoidable admissions to hospital, which is costing us more money than any other single inefficiency in the system. And I'll come back to talk about that in a minute. We have talked about the fact that there's $20 billion estimated to be spent on low-value or no-value care. This is an enormous challenge to my profession and all other health professionals who are engaged in healthcare delivery, that we must get involved in more emphasis on peer-reviewed critical pathways that mandate that best practice involves this and that, and that we don't do all these arthroscopies and imaging of low backs, etc., which benefit no one except the person that providing the service. The private health insurance rebate. Michael Armitage wouldn't agree to this, but the evidence is absolutely overwhelming for two major factors. First of all, the rebate had nothing to do with the increase in uptake of private health insurance in Australia. After the rebate was introduced, there was only a 2% increase in the uptake of private health insurance. And secondly, this has not taken any pressure off the public hospital systems. As I'll come back to say in a minute, private hospitals in Australia, which do a very good job in much of what they're doing, but they occupy a different universe from public hospitals, quite different universe. And I'll say a bit more about that later on. But the $5 billion spent on the private health insurance rebate would be much better spent on in being invested in prevention, in public hospitals and the like. We'd get much, could extract much more health from those dollars than through this rebate. The duplication, 9 departments of health for 22 million, 23 million people, that's costing us two, or Ian McCauley tells us, $4 million on duplication. It's an absolutely ridiculous situation to have. And having worked with these jurisdictions for 20, 30 years, you see the loggerheads of the bureaucrats in the states, and it's not a happy world. They're all fighting and trying to cost shift, and instead of acting productively as if they're part of one family with one mission. In Australia, in this most scientific of all ages, we have Australians hoodwinked into spending $2 to $3 billion a year on supplements, and the penetration of pseudoscience into our healthcare system in this day and age is quite remarkable. All of the chiropractors that are saying that bring your children to us and we'll adjust their spine and help you with their autism, their asthma, their bedwetting. The osteopaths with their osteocranial therapy, we can feel these pulsations from the spinal cord which tell us what's the disease you've got. Registered by APRA, a great mistake that the previous government made. But and all of the implications to Australia that you can neutralise an unhealthy lifestyle by taking Swiss this or Blackmore's that, has seen us spending so much money on health. It's an indication that Australians want to spend money on improving their health, but they're being directed into spending it in the wrong way. And $2 billion on unnecessary length of medical education. It takes longer to train a neurosurgeon in Australia than anywhere else in the world. And the colleges and universities have been extending the time it takes to train someone. You can enter medical school in America and 6 years later you can be a well-accredited family physician. So there's enormous areas that we should be looking at in terms of improving efficiency before we ask Australians to pay more. Now, just quickly, let me say something about the public hospital problems because these are intimately involved in what I think are the directions that we have to be advocating. And quickly, I can say this because they're pretty obvious to all of you who have ever been near our public hospitals recently. But demand outstrips financial and physical capacity. On average, we have a 3 to 5% increase in admissions of sicker and older medical patients each year. In New South Wales, EDs experienced 7 to 11% increase in visits in, it'd probably be more in 2103 the way we're going, but that meant to be 2013. Physical infrastructure hinders efficiency. The hospitals, many of our hospitals, great people, great service, being offered under circumstances where the physical infrastructure really hinders efficiency. Taxpayer subsidy of private health insurance has not removed significant pressures from public hospitals. They offer different universes. 72% of people in private hospitals are there for a surgical or procedural matter. Very small numbers are there for medical problems, whereas over 70% of people in public hospitals are there for medical problems, chronic medical problems. There are only 12 private hospitals in Australia with an emergency department. All the emergency medicine is done in the public health system. That means if you've got a level 6 emergency department, you've got to have an ICU and all the other things that go with it. I've mentioned that to you. It was the age rating that saw the levy that saw the significant increase in private health. There's a system-wide, thank you very much, Joe, system-wide intense effort to improve efficiency and minimise misadventure in hospitals. Activity-based accounting that Tony was talking about is a good tool for understanding costs and clinical efficiency. But what we didn't get a chance to talk to about is activity-based funding is a misnomer. Tanya Plibersek used to walk around before the election saying, you do the work, I'll pay you for it. You know, as long as you do it efficiently, keep doing it and we'll pay you. But of course, public hospital budgets are fixed. They're fixed at the beginning of the year. And I've yet to hear of one unit that on its activity-based funding scale was found to be efficient and came in under budget where they were able to keep the money if the hospital was over budget. So there's no incentive when cardiologists say, well, we've got $10,000 left. Look, we go and buy a piece of equipment. And they say, oh, hospital's $3 million over budget in your dreams. But the accounting, so that we understand our business, is terribly important. But hospitals, public hospitals are really struggling, as it is. And then, of course, we have many political imperatives that so often hinder cost and quality improvements. For example, we know from an abundance of literature that many of our hospitals should be subjected to role delineation. We don't want 9 trauma units in Sydney. Melbourne's got 2. We don't want more than 2 hospitals doing complicated surgery for cancer of the esophagus. And yet, the politicians have never had the courage to say to 2 hospitals that may only be 10 minutes away, you can do this and you can do that. And the rebranding of emergency departments. And many emergency departments around Australia don't have an emergency physician available. They're still called emergency departments. They should be called acute care centres or something else. Now, continuous operational improvement is always possible, but in the current situation, I don't see any future where the hospital is going to get on top of all of the legitimate demands made upon it at the moment through efficiency gains. Then we get the May budget, and COAG agreement on Commonwealth contribution to hospital funding is ripped up. States lose $80 billion of promised funding and a partnership in sharing rising costs equally, plus hundreds of millions from needed Commonwealth grants are cancelled. We already have more overnight beds than any other country in the OECD, and right this second we need more. We have emergency departments jammed up, the river's not flowing because we don't have enough beds to admit all the people we want to do. So we need more in the present system. And the thing that's become perfectly obvious is that quality hospital care in the future all depends on demand reduction for hospital services, which brings us full circle back to where the emphasis should be in the structural reform in the healthcare system in Australia. It is absolutely crucial for quality hospital services that those avoidable admissions are reduced. And what's happening is that, as I say, 70% of the patients are medical patients, often with chronic conditions, and the result has been that public hospitals are doing less and less surgery. The result of that is that the surgeons in frustration move over to the private sector, And the huge problem that we have in the gap that is charged between what is charged by surgeons and what the scheduled fee is causing, is one of the reasons why Australians spend $29 billion out of their pocket for healthcare, because there's no competition anymore. If you could get your cataract done at Prince of Wales Hospital in 6 weeks, you'd say fine. But if it's going to take 18 months, of course, you're desperate, you're going to go to the private sector. And you may have a surgeon that's going to ask for $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 for that procedure. And until we rebalance that and allow hospitals to get back to doing more surgery, etc., we're having problems. Gap payments for surgery will only fall when public hospitals can compete with the private sector for those things which many public hospitals have had to abandon. Management of the huge societal burden associated with chronic and complex disease management is costing us a fortune and results in much personal suffering. There is no doubt that much of this suffering is preventable, but only providing our primary care system with the prevention infrastructure needed. Many quality studies have been done looking at preventable hospital admissions in Australia. They're defined as avoidable in that they had there been an effective community intervention in the 3 weeks prior to admission, it could have been avoided. Would you believe 600,000 avoidable admissions utilising 7 million bed days per year, a study that Melbourne University did in 2012, costing us an absolute fortune, let alone the misery and suffering involved. Surely it's economics 101 that if you were thinking system-wide, you would put the infrastructure in to stop those admissions, reduce the hospital burden, allow them to function more effectively, etc., and have a win-win situation. $5 billion more spent on Medicare could save $20 billion in hospital expenditure. And there's plenty of evidence around the world for that. In Southern California, integrated primary care medical homes, which we've talked about a lot in the last couple of days, in many areas, hospital admissions over the last 10 years have fallen 42%. A win-win for everybody. In New South Wales, 8.9% of people who leave a public hospital are back in hospital in a month because of that lack of capacity in the in the community to take the patients up and look after them. Now, I don't have time to go through what I think are the slides I'll leave to make available to you, but there is a clear vision of what a medical home, what an integrated primary care centre should look like. Team medicine, our medical education sector, we are looking at emphasising interprofessional learning so that health students, spend a bit of their curriculum with each other, so that nurses, doctors, allied health professionals, dentists, they appreciate the unique skills they have and then can see how in a patient-focused way joining those skills together is a very happy professional model to work with. And one of the major reasons we haven't discussed this, but one of the major reasons we need this new model of care is that it's very attractive to young doctors. In Australia, a survey done 18 months ago showed that only 13% of medical students graduating had any intention of being involved in primary care. And only 13% of those would consider a country career. young doctors look at their mates who are maybe doing a procedure here, doing endoscopy or something, 3 days a week, earning $500,000 a year. And then Mr. Abbott tells them, look, I'm going to reduce your occasion of service fee from $36 to $31. We need this new model of care, which has excited New Zealand doctors. 85% of GPs in New Zealand have moved away from fee-for-service to a structured contractual basis. 85% of the community are enrolled in a primary healthcare organisation, which emphasises health. As I was saying before, the whole concept that staying healthy, okay, you're blessed with good health, but so many people lose that blessing and need guidance and health education, health literacy, etc. So we've got to emphasise structural reform. Now, I'm just going to quickly slip through to my ACRA slides, because all of this is pretty. There is plenty of international evidence on this. At ACRA, we have consistently asked for a single funder, the Commonwealth, a separate agency for contracting providers, regional health authorities, not getting away from all the state border nonsense, patient-focused integration, the establishment of integrated primary care, what the Americans, I think, cleverly and well call medical homes, and a national electronic health record, and the rural disadvantage we've heard about this morning. I do want to finish with two thoughts. First of all, how on earth do we pitch these structural reforms to governments that are only interested in four-year cycles, sometimes three-year cycles? And I think the concept of pitching these reforms as a reform journey, as a journey, is terribly important. One plans a journey after deciding definitely on a destination. We need to have a clear vision of a destination that after the reforms settle down, if we can manufacture them, this is what we'll have for a health system. If I want to spend next summer in Paris, if I've been waiting to do this all my life, and I want to spend a month in Paris, that absolutely is my destination. I want to go to Paris. There'll be hurdles along the way, and careful, thorough, and planning are essential. Unforeseen problems must be addressed. Well, the government's Paris is patient-focused integration. And to get there, we should be advocating, I believe, for a transition authority to implement the journey to a new model of care. Of course, first of all, we've got to convince the government that we need to have any changes. The destination is not negotiable. The length of the journey is less predictable, but the journey milestones are well marked. Because if we don't put this out in terms of a longer-term strategy, the politicians tend to turn off, as you know. So what about ACRA in the future? I think its role is more important than ever. We've heard other people say this, but I think it's urgent that in the current climate that not only the politicians you're meeting tomorrow, but these new senators, God knows what will be their approach, but since the balance of power is so delicate, I think meeting them is important. We have to continue to be the champions of equity and to be able to emphasize that, again, this is not the emotional left, inequity is bloody expensive. Inequity costs a fortune. Expand the conversation with Australia. The big danger is the possibility of a two-tiered system. I think we have a major responsibility as a number of like-minded organisations who are respected to put up that possibility, more of the possibility of a two-tiered system. Medicare is in real danger from the best friend Medicare ever had. We need to work on Labor Green policies. I think that, as I said to Catherine King on the first day, I heard Bill Shorten the other day was asked a question about the immigration inhumanity, and he wouldn't answer. He said, we're in opposition now. That's not our job. Australians are fed up with that. They want to hear what the alternatives are, just like we're putting forward alternatives in a structured fashion. We need to continue the expansion. I believe that ACRA was born readily and easily. It was not a difficult birth because at the time that I set it up, it literally took me 12 hours to call six or seven organizations where I knew people. As in the previous 24 hours, Kay Patterson, perhaps the least adequate health minister I've ever dealt with, Kay Patterson had pulled the plug on 14 reform initiatives that had been put up to COAG instead of just looking at finance. And there was such frustration after many of us had put in months of work on this. And Craig Knowles, the health minister in New South Wales, had convinced the health ministers that we should build in reform agendas into the COAG discussions. Boom, gone. And it was easy. I called Nurses Federation, Public Health Association, the College of General Practitioners, and within 12 hours I had a number of people who said, yes, we've got to start speaking as one voice. Well, ACRA was born. Now, at the moment, I think there is such dissatisfaction with this unfairness of this budget, and the need to speaking strongly with one voice is so great that it's a time when we should be, the new ACRA executive should be reaching out to other organisations, try and build this up, because the unique feature of ACRA is that all the associations have their own thing that they concentrate on and focus on, but to have so many people from consumers to nurses to allied health, to bureaucrats, to doctors, all speaking with one voice is unique. And that strengthening that voice, I think, is terribly important. I think we need a blog from Accra. I haven't got time to go into all of the reasons for that. Many of you will probably know more about it than I do, but I now write columns for a number of blogs. I am staggered at the reach of the blogs, that the number of people. You know, I write one blog for John Menadue, and we started off, he started that off, and maybe there were 50, 60 people reading it a week. Now it's 40,000. Championing of the oral health campaign, we have, I could say that Accra has had a marvellous record of championing that. More involvement with rural health inequities and continued emphasis on structural reform. I'm proud of you. I'm very delighted to have been here with you and to have the opportunity to share these thoughts with you. God bless you and keep it up. Thank you very much.